Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.
I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 420, part two of my conversation with historian Peter Levy about what he calls the Great Uprising, the race riots of the 1960s. There were far more of them than most Americans probably realize, at least 750 of them, from Newark to Los Angeles, from Detroit to Baltimore. According to Peter Levy's new history, upwards of 525 cities were affected by the uprising. The two largest waves came in 1967 and during the spring of 1968, after the assassination in Memphis of civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. In those 2 years alone, 67 and 68, 125 people were killed, nearly 7,000 injured. Law enforcement officers made 45,000 arrests, and property damage reached what today would be close to $1 billion. Peter Levy argues that, regarded collectively, the Great Uprising was, like the Great War and the Great Depression, one of the central developments of the 20th century. In Baltimore, 1,200 fires broke out, 1,000 businesses were destroyed, 6 people died, 700 were injured, and nearly 6,000 arrested. The Maryland governor, Spiro Agnew, the future vice president of the United States, sent in the National Guard to restore order. For the Sun's 50-year retrospective in April, reporter Gene Marbella wrote, "Even as they receded in memory over the years, the 68 riots have remained a touchstone in Baltimore, and an explanation, fair or not, for the many woes that have beset the city in the intervening decades, white and middle-class flight to the suburbs, the resegregation of city schools, the block upon crumbled block of empty buildings, the persistent distrust between police and parts of the community." The 68 riots came to mind when parts of Baltimore burned again in a shorter outburst on another April night in 2015 after Freddie Gray died in police custody. There were also riots in Cambridge on Maryland's Eastern Shore, and in episode 419 of Roughly Speaking, we told the story of the race riots and deaths that occurred in York in southern Pennsylvania. The full story of the conditions that precipitated the uprisings in Baltimore, Cambridge, and York counters suggestions, somewhat hardened by time, that the riots were provoked by outside agitators and radicals. Rather, as Peter Levy demonstrates, deep-seated grievances, the result of decades of racism, poverty, and oppression, were the very real causes of the uprisings. Peter Levy is the author of The Great Uprising, Race Riots in Urban America During the 1960s, published this year by Cambridge University Press. Peter Levy is a professor of history at York College. Well, we're both children of the 60s.
Yes.
So we remember the nightly news stories about rioting in Detroit, Watts. Those are the big ones. Then Baltimore after the death of Martin Luther King Jr. But there were all these others. There were so many. I didn't appreciate that till I read your book. I guess that's why you wanted to write the book.
Yeah, I don't even think I knew how many there were. You know, I was only 12 years old when King was assassinated.
I was 14.
And you know, 9 when Watts took place. I was probably paying more attention to baseball at the time.
Right.
And then I first learned about a riot that had taken place in Cambridge, and that got me exploring more things that had taken place in Baltimore and then where I teach in York, Pennsylvania.
Your first book was about the Cambridge, Maryland riots. There were two in, what, 63, 64?
Correct. So what first got me interested in Cambridge, and I didn't know Cambridge, Maryland from Cambridge, Massachusetts or Cambridge, England, was I had heard that H. Rapp Brown had allegedly incited this riot there. And I was interested in looking at that period. Lo and behold, next thing I knew, there's this vibrant, quite contentious movement in Cambridge in the early 1960s. Which included the National Guard being brought into town really twice for over a year, 63 and 64.
What's your reluctance about using the word riot?
I think riot just reaffirms this notion that somehow it was spontaneous and, more importantly, that it was apolitical. I think we think of riots as just people go crazy all of a sudden. And an uprising connects it with the struggle for equality that had been ongoing. So I think uprising better portrays what I'm trying to argue took place in the 1960s. It's not just in single communities. It's all across the country. There's an uprising taking place. I didn't use the term rebellion because I think rebellions have a sense of being more organized. So they're not strictly spontaneous, but they are political.
And they're racial.
And they're racial, yes.
I mean, when we're talking about the uprisings of the 60s, these uprisings, these events occurred in places where there were minority populations seeking all kinds of things. Well, seeking equality, seeking better treatment by the police, by the local governments.
Yeah, I think that's yeah.
By,
I mean, they are
private businesses.
I mean, yeah. I mean, racism is just pervasive, and it affects really everything from jobs to housing to criminal justice system. And there's a desire to be treated as an equal human being.
This mini war that took place in York, Pennsylvania, it underscores something you say in your book that there are different types of uprisings, different types of riots. I think you use the term commodity riot. To describe a certain type of riot. I think the riot that occurred in Baltimore here, we're talking about attacks on property, destruction of property. But in York, it was very personal, wasn't it? It was sort of mano a mano. It was man to man, was neighbors across the people who live in the same city actually shooting at each other.
Yeah, so people who've looked at riots or revolts historically know, say, in the early part of the 20th century, riots tended to be interpersonal, or what they call communal riots. Most often, whites attacking blacks. I mean, the worst examples of this would have been in a place like Tulsa, where essentially the white community committed what might best call a pogrom, in which they drove the blacks out of the community. Chicago earlier in the century kind of been really bloody. But scholars at the time, and pretty much since, have made the argument that mostly what took place in the riots of the 1960s were these commodity riots, attacks on property, looting, arson. There were discussions of snipers. Most people have argued that the reports of sniping was vastly overreported. Either that or the snipers were terrible shots, because by and large, most of the people who were injured or killed in all the revolts were black, and in many cases by police or National Guardsmen. So that was Baltimore.
I had a question for you about the nature of your book. It's sort of groundbreaking in a way. It pulls together all this history across the 1960s in the United States. There's a lot of data and information in here that I wasn't aware of. I didn't realize the scope of the uprising, really. As I said at the outset, there's a few cities that you know about, but then there's all these other uprisings that took place. So I wonder, on the scholarship of this, are people who have examined the history of the civil rights movement, who are largely sympathetic to that movement, that they don't like to address the rioting that occurred after the death of, say, Dr. King in the spring of 68, that the civil rights history kind of stops there because of that sympathy with the movement and a sort of protectionism, a feeling that to associate the movement with violence, which, you know, a nonviolent movement with violence, is not something we want to spend a lot of time thinking about. This is a complicated part of your scholarship here. So I wanted to examine that with you a little bit. Do you think that's behind some of it, that there's a bias in not looking at something?
Yeah, I mean, I myself probably shared some of that bias. And originally was going to have a chapter just on memory. You know, why is it that we spend much more time on that other part of the movement? So there's a really good historian named Jean Theo Harris who just came out with the book. And, you know, she makes the argument that largely what we want is a fable. We want a good story. And it's just
heroic
journey. It's just much more complicated than that. And ultimately, if you look at it in its complexity, I think it becomes a more enriching story. But it's not just the civil rights movement. I think for American history in general, we want to have a sense of a progressive narrative. We want to have a sense that things are always getting better somewhat linearly. So this isn't the only kind of subject matter that we kind of push aside. My mentor was a guy named Eric Foner, who's a famous historian whose real masterpiece was on Reconstruction. Well, there, you know, you can spend years on tours of the Civil War, yet I think we're still battling to have some museum or some type of things dedicated to remember Reconstruction, because, you know, Reconstruction is this period we're saying let's have African Americans be equal, and then we say, oh no, never mind that, and we kind of move back to slavery light with Jim Crow. And I think the riots are the same way. So, you know, we don't want to look at the fact, particularly in the North, that there was this great migration and blacks saw it as the promised land. And King himself acknowledged when that dream was deferred, things exploded. So we either focus on that good civil rights movement or we tend to demonize those who participated in the rioting.
Also, I don't know that Americans like to look at social and economic problems that underlie the rioting, the uprising.
Yeah, and it's much harder, for example, and I'm not going to criticize newspapers here, but if you're going to do it, you know, you're going to do it with photographs, you're going to do it with memories, and so the photographs tend to emphasize the sensational, the looted or burning building, the person shot by a sniper. It's much harder to portray these social and economic kind of conditions that created it. I mean, how do you describe, you know, vividly the lack of adequate housing in a community for years after years?
You could do it with photographs.
But it's a lot harder.
It's harder. It is. And it isn't as sensational as a burning building. And we saw that in 2015 with the April unrest in Baltimore City that, you know, CNN and other cable channels repeatedly showed the burning Southern Baptist Church on the east side of town and burning cars and drugstores on the west side. And that's all it looks like, right? So if you're watching it from someplace else, even overseas, you're seeing, well, that's the whole story that's offered, at least by television. Now, in the press, I wanted to ask you about this because it speaks to this bias that because we in the press do examine problems, we often get labeled as being liberal, right? That you're from that other side because all you do is want to examine and re-examine, say, racism or poverty or whatever problem that Americans really don't like to look at because we don't like to consider failures. We don't like to consider flaws in our democracy. And so I've been hearing this for 40 years as a journalist, and I think that's at the root of it, that people really don't want they don't want problems pushed in their face like that.
Yeah, matter of fact, when I talk about York, there's a story that just, you know, speaks to this. So the York's paper was actually somewhat unusual. It was a small town paper, quite progressive, run by this guy named J.W. Gitt. And he actually ran some stories on the persistence of bad and inadequate housing in York. And he was friends with one of the leading industrialists in the city, and they would meet at this relatively elite club over breakfast. And his friend said to him, you know, why are you running these stories? I can't eat my breakfast. It's, you know, it's kind of not that different than people saying how Vietnam brought the war into your dinner table.
Yeah.
And he said, well, why don't you change to housing? And, you know, and the reality was that Gitt's paper was viewed, this is in the 60s. This is before, I think, liberalism became this kind of naughty word.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the paper was viewed as this, it wasn't as really pinkish, as almost reddish in the town. And there were two newspapers, and the more conservative newspaper tended to get the larger readership, I think, at the time.
So, again, back to the scholarship on uprisings and the civil rights movement. You think there is that bias there that overlooked this because of, you know, a reluctance to associate or because they thought the history was that heroic journey that you talked about?
Yeah, I'm not going to blame scholars because the scholars aren't as widely read. I'm saying, you know, kind of the popularizers.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I love Taylor Branch's work. I wouldn't critique it if it didn't deserve attention.
But it's
he ends with King's death.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is that it's a focus just on King, but he also ends with his death. And so that the public, those who read Taylor Branch, wouldn't even know that Baltimore necessarily had a revolt, or that the single largest wave of riots took place after King's death. Or if they knew it, they would only know it kind of tangentially or inferentially.
What were your thoughts when the uprising occurred here in Baltimore? After the death of Freddie Gray, leading up to the day of his funeral, that whole very tense week and week after? What were you thinking at the time as being a historian of this?
Well, I remember when I was rewriting my chapter on Baltimore, the uprising took place in Baltimore, and I'm driving down from York, and I'm listening to the news, and a newscaster whose name I will not provide, you know, says, I can't believe this is happening. And I'm saying to myself, where has she been the last 40 years? I mean, I had these maps, for instance, that showed that the residential segregation of Baltimore that existed in the 1960s is virtually mapped to the residential segregation of Baltimore today. And in many ways, I think you could make the argument conditions are worse.
I looked at that map in your book. and I was struck by how similar it is to where we are today.
Yeah, and so it's really easy because other communities like Canton and Fells Point or even Locust Point have enjoyed this degree of kind of what we call gentrification or revival. But East Baltimore, West Baltimore were in just, if not worse shape. In fact, economically, you know, the unemployment rates are much, much higher now than they were than they were in 1968, because we're still in the middle of the Vietnam War. The number of blacks who are incarcerated today just is phenomenally larger than it was in 1968. So in some ways, relations with the police are even worse, I think. So I don't think people were surprised. I lamented it. And my guess is when people begin to study even more what caused the 2015 uprising, we'll see parallels, not just with the anger, but I think there were activists in the street trying to change things, and the city was really too slow. I think particularly the call for civilian review boards, there's nothing new about that. This goes back to the early 1960s in city after city, and it goes in waves. But the police force, by and large, has resisted a call for civilian review boards. Not that that's a panacea.
And you can look at the Kerner Commission report that was ordered up by President Johnson in 1967, right, before 68. And the Otto Kerner was the governor of Ohio, and he chaired this commission that basically said that we have a segregated society and all kinds of problems associated with that. And I'm not sure that it'd be much different today if Otto Kerner was around, right?
No. Yeah. And the commission report actually ends with they quote Kenneth Clark. Clark was the famous sociologist who was instrumental in the Brown decision. And he said, look, there's been commission reports of earlier riots and people ignored those commission reports. And he said, it's kind of deja vu all over again. It's going to happen again. And he was right. People did ignore the Kerner commission report. And I can just add that one of the reasons they ignored it was not just because President Johnson put it aside, but because Maryland's own Spiro Agnew was one of the main voices criticizing the report, in his famous language, making the argument that it blamed everyone but those who rioted themselves. And I think we see parallels today. We see with the Baltimore uprising of 2015 that there was kind of a similar split in public opinion. I think I read one poll that close to two-thirds of all whites argued that blacks who claimed that they were protesting or rioting in 2015 because of police abuse were just using that as an excuse to loot.
We remember hearing that in 67 and 68, that they were outside agitators or just, yes, they had some convenient excuse to loot, right?
Yeah.
And often you found in your research that just wasn't the case.
Yeah, man, that's why Cambridge becomes so interesting, because Cambridge was the poster boy for here is a radical who gives a fiery address, and the next thing you know, this town explodes. And H.R.A.P. Brown gave a fiery address in Cambridge, and a fire took place. But those who investigated closely, including the Kerner Commission, including the National Guard commander, a guy named General Gelston, who deserves a biography of his own, had argued that that's not what took place. Brown kind of gave the speech, and about 2 hours later, a fire took place, and the fire company refused to put the fire out because it had been odds with the black community for virtually a decade.
Right, and there have been earlier complaints by blacks in Cambridge about not being able to use a movie theater, not being able to eat in a restaurant.
Yeah, and not even able to use this. One of the main complaints was actually a suit against the fire company's just beautiful pool that had opened up in the mid-1950s as the largest pool east of the Mississippi River. And in 1966, the courts had ordered the fire company, it's an all-white volunteer fire company, to open the pool up, and the chief, who was also the chief of police, Bryce Kinnaman, closed the pool down rather than integrate it. This fire company had been long at odds. In fact, one of Baltimore's most famous, or really he's a native of Cambridge, but he'd been in Baltimore in 1967, was a guy named John Barth. He was a famous writer, and he criticized that fire company, which his father belonged to, arguing that they were as much responsible for what took place in Cambridge's.
Interesting. John Barth, who was teaching at Hopkins, wrote The Sotweed Factor and other books, other novels. Yeah.
And he took a lot of flack for criticizing his own for doing
it,
that. Yeah, this was kind of a brave break.
Peter, was it something that you discovered in your research for this book that surprised you, that you didn't know about a particular incident in a particular city, small town?
I think maybe what you noted before, that it was just so widespread.
Yeah.
You know, I think
you
I came
750. How many?
Yeah, and at first I wanted to poo-poo that number. I want to say, oh, that's vast.
What
I think there are roughly 750 revolts in roughly 500 cities. So some cities like Cambridge had more than one. And originally I was saying, well, maybe the press is just picking up on this. But in fact, that doesn't even include prison revolts. We know that, you know, Attica's famous, but there were a series of prison revolts in the early 1970s. And I think only at the tip of the iceberg of looking at you know, what might best be described as kind of riots or revolts that took place in schools all across the country in the late 60s and 1970s.
In high schools.
In high school. I went to a high school that my parents didn't want us to send us to because my sister was 4 years older than 1970. There were racial turmoil there. I know in York, it's not even counted that in 1970 there was a near another riot over kind of, you know, people described it as fights, but these just weren't normal fights. These were fights because blacks were beginning to assert themselves. They wanted, you know, to wear their hair differently. They wanted to assert themselves. They wanted more blacks on the faculty. They wanted better counseling. And there was resistance. So, yeah, it's widespread. I mean, it's just really widespread.
It's an ongoing struggle, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that's
look where we are
thing.
Today. I mean, we don't have any riots to report today, but it's all these problems are still there, and the racism is some in some ways even more blatant than it used to be.
But that's why I think it's important to look at it. I mean, so in other words, it's like if you had a patient who had a chronic condition, and you said, "Let's not look at that." I don't want to look at these revolts to just to look at the violence of the revolts, but really to ask the question: what were the conditions that produced them, so that we avoid them again?
It is interesting that today the reaction to racism is so quick and strong. There is that. I mean, actually, we're recording this a day after Roseanne Barr had her TV show canceled because of a racist tweet by ABC. Her show is gone, right? So I guess you can look at that and say that there's some progress there, right?
Yeah, I'm kind of divided on that.
How do you feel about it?
It was interesting. Valerie Jarrett said, "Let's use this as a teachable moment," but then they cut her off on the clip. We don't get to see what happened afterwards. So right. I know this one of the guys I most admire is this guy named Brian Stevenson, who's this very famous attorney who just recently opened this wonderful museum in Montgomery about lynchings.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And you know, and his idea is we need to confront the racism rather than just say, "Well, if someone's racist, let's remove that."
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think his response to the fact that Montgomery is a city of Confederate monuments is let's put a museum there that reminds us what the Confederacy, what Jim Crow stood for, and do it with a lynching museum.
All right. And he wants to put markers around the country where lynchings occurred. There was a lynching in Towson. Actually, we covered it on the podcast last year, right outside the county, what used to be the county jail.
So, yeah, it's almost to me, yes, we've made progress, but I'd rather we have the broader discussion rather than once someone says something, we just cut it off and then we kind of move on and say, oh, okay, that's
current. Well, what's the teachable part? Don't write racist tweets.
Well, no, I think to have a larger discussion of who Roseanne Barr is and, you know,
what she represents.
You know, it's not just this one tweet.
Yeah.
You know, to me, it allows for a further exploration of the racism that's at the core of Trump supporters, whether they're even aware of it or not.
Yeah.
So they're not uttering in public all the time that blacks are apes. If that's what they're feeling, we haven't made that much progress.
Peter Levy is the author of The Great Uprising, Race Riots in Urban America During the 1960s, published by Cambridge University Press. He is a professor of history at York College and lives in Towson. You can hear the first part of my discussion with him, all about the race riots of 1969 in York, Pennsylvania, in episode 419. I'm Dan Rodericks of the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking again, and we'll see you soon.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.